Bitcoin can't be money because the state doesn't force it on everyone. This is the worst news. I am devastated. Today we dive into an enlightening Twitter post by Samantha Leduc. And I do get heated and I do have my normal guy's rants. But I will say, if Samantha ever listens to this, I mean no disrespect. And I do not fault anyone for thinking differently than I do. We are a product of our environment and the information that we have access to. But nonetheless, I wholeheartedly disagree. And simply put, a very elementary understanding of monetary history is all that's needed to disprove it. But there's a lot more to unpack here as well. And so, I think it's time for a Guy's Take episode. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan. And this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. And we are getting into a Guy's Take episode today. This show, by the way, is brought to you by Swan Bitcoin and CoinKite. That is the place to buy your Bitcoin and the device to withdraw it to. Buy Bitcoin on Swan and have it automatically withdraw to your cold card hardware wallet. There is a no simpler, quicker way to being a sovereign Bitcoiner. The links to both will be right in the show notes for your convenience. So today, I'm going to try to be respectful. She specifically mentions that there were both respectful and disrespectful rebuttals to her comments or challenges of Bitcoin as money. And so I would like her to actually listen to this, because the premise of her argument is based on a couple of very clear fallacies, in my opinion. Ones that are actually incredibly easy to rebut and genuinely have no logical or historical foundation, despite the fact that they are widely believed. And if she is actually open to this conversation, she's actually open to hearing why her premise is wrong, and therefore completely changing the logical thought process, the conclusions. Well, if we are unable to even listen to a serious counterargument, then obviously we will never be able to change our opinion or learn something new. So I make that appeal to her that hopefully she listens to this. But this is a thread from Samantha Leduc, and she is trying to illustrate the differences in thinking and the challenge of, quote, TradFi, of traditional finance, failure to understand or failure to come agreement with Bitcoiners on the value case, the reason that Bitcoin exists, and whether or not it has any real value. So let's just go ahead and read the thread, read her argument, and then I will break it down. And you know what? Just for fun, I'm going to train an AI on her voice, and we're going to use some fun tools that we've covered on AI Unchained so that we can read her tweet in her voice. And I will do the voice acting. I probably won't do very well because I haven't really listened to her much. But here we go.
Here's my attempt to summarize key disagreements between TradFi and Bitcoiners. There is no premium in scarcity just because it's limited. But this is the major claim that has been offered up by Bitcoiners in both the respectful plus disrespectful rebuttals, my very busy feed of the past 24 hours. TradFi gets that value is not assigned just because something is scarce. We assign even less value in Bitcoin given all the concentration risk of ownership, corrupt actors, Russia, China, charlatans, crime, and confiscations. But here's where TradFi folks really align. Bitcoin is not money. Beyond the core monetary commodity circulation attributes of money, actual money has to be measured in relation to a demanded in-kind commodity or currency or asset. And it has to be forced on us by the government, for example, taxes in local FX. So why would TradFi folks in mass trade in-kind real assets for Bitcoin, other than with disposable money, because of Bitcoin's speculative properties? Bitcoin is, quote, a convertible currency with an equivalent value in real currency. The state does not force or enforce Bitcoin as a real currency. So it is not money. So we can trade it, transact with it where we can, but it is too much risk for the reward for those who have money. For those who need it, I agree, it is a powerful, effective payment system. Does that sound elitist or just realist? Speaking from a TradFi perspective, Dicoin is a great little alt investment to diversify returns from equities or otherwise, real estate, real commodities, even cash that earns interest, etc. But the main reason most TradFi types have no interest in it is because they don't need or trust get-rich schemes. And they know those with real power and money know how to take yours away. Sadly, if I was a betting woman, I would say this is now their tool to use against you. Hashtag Bitcoin ETFs. I'm sorry, it's not fair. They suck. I'm not being facetious. Maybe you will change the game by changing the players or the pieces, but until then, Bitcoin does not meet the definition of money. Regardless if the Bitcoin gospel writers have changed the definition of money or intrinsic value or ascribe Bitcoin with the characteristics of money, value, trust, scarcity, or whatever. Bitcoin is rogue money, which is on the opposite spectrum to sound money. Rogue money has a purpose, but not transformational power, unless you change the state and get it to literally force it upon us. In the meantime, Bitcoiners, feel free to treat crypto assets as a cause within a religion, but don't disrespect those who don't share your beliefs. Hashtag TradFi. We can survive and thrive together. It's not all or nothing. But do study the strengths and weaknesses of your new weapon of change. For example, I can call U.S. dollar, quote, monopoly money because it can be printed, devalued, debased, de-dollarized. But it is still the tool that enables all other tools. I hope Bitcoin sticks around and grows more popular. But in its current form, to most in TradFi, it is the opposite of sound money, especially if it takes cult-like behavior to make it grow. It needs the state to force its use on everyone. That is what makes it money. And what are the Vegas odds for that? Especially since you disdain the state and the state disdains your rogueness. Final word. There are many here in TradFi who don't dismiss you, but that doesn't mean we will ever convert to your gospel of Bitcoin or worship terms most of you don't understand, like debasement. Seriously, how many of you ever knew this term existed before jumping on the Bitcoin train? Warning, this one term has become the calling card for enabling this cult-like separateness. Your rogue miss is cool, but wishing or promoting bad things on your state is a really bad investment framework. To do so, you just separate yourselves even farther away from the people and policies that will continue to label you and your money as rogue.
Whew. Okay, so that was the thread. And if you have seen the explosion of rogue money memes out there, this is what it is referencing. So with respect to Samantha, and I don't know much about her, or I didn't really explore the videos that she has on her blog, or her page very much, but this is so indicative of something I've seen for years. I mean, I've been in Bitcoin for 12 years now. Actually, probably more like 13. And one thing that I see a lot is that people in finance think that they understand money because they're in finance. But I cannot say this clearly enough. Finance and money have nothing to do with each other. The study of these two things, these two disciplines, are completely opposite. It's the same as the conflation that people make between business and economics. They're like, oh, that guy's really good at economics, and then he fails at a business. Like, oh, I guess his economics is stupid. He doesn't know what he's doing. Business has nothing to do with economics. In an extremely similar way, finance is around money. It deals with currency. It looks at a bunch of charts. Like, what they think of as finance has nothing to do with fundamental money. There is nothing. You can live your entire life in the financial sector and be incredibly good at it and never have the first clue how to distinguish between a good money and a bad money. And this thread seems to be a pretty good example of that. With respect, the most glaring thing in this thread that could not be more perfectly the opposite of anything related to the history of money is the fact that money can't be money unless the government forces it on us. And this is partly in line and probably slightly built on the same fallacy of money has to be redeemable for some specific commodity, something quote-unquote in kind, which literally the history of money just shows that neither one of those things have nothing to do with what money is. For the longest time, all government ever did was coin the thing that became money as a trusted source for verifying that it was real money. It was a shortcut for verification. It had nothing to do with establishing that that was the money. The government was never, ever going to be able to, if gold became the money, they were never going to be able to enforce and make silver the money. In fact, China did that, and they went from one of the most powerful empires. Their history of empires and basically dominance of the world monetary and kind of global power structure is actually far longer, and they've been at the height of the world power many more times than any other country. China has been a dominant force in the world. One of the big reasons that they failed was that towards the end of the 1800s, they bet on silver while the West bet on gold. They tried to re-monetize silver, and the stock-to-flow ratio destroyed them, because while silver was at the time, let's say mid-1800s, was at the time very stable in relation to its scarcity versus gold scarcity. The change in technology and the ultimate, the greater ease of our technology to mine and bring more silver production into the market basically ruined that ratio. And this is the story of monetary history, is that monies are obsoleted by technological advancements, not because some government said this was going to be money instead of this. To the contrary, every government that said something that was bad money was going to be used as the money either destroyed the government or the society or both. The government historically has the shittiest record of all in trying to make something that is a bad money actually work as one. But the gold to silver ratio went from, I think the historical norm going back to the early 1800s to mid 1800s was like 1 to 12, 1 to 16, 1 to 20 kind of range. And now it's something like 1 to 90, I think. And now this wasn't the only reason that China declined during that era. That's a very long and complicated story, but nonetheless, that was a big factor. But the specifics of any one case are far less important than the fact that the government has never been able to deny the market reality of the money by saying this is going to work instead. It was and always has been that for the length of time that their virtual money can mimic the characteristics of real money, it will work. But governments cannot and never have given up the immense power to debase the currency or print credit out of thin air. They cannot resist it. And this is why the history of government-enforced fiat currency is literally the shittiest and most volatile era of money in all of human history. So what Samantha here is equating as necessary for the existence of money is actually an incredibly short period at the very tip of modern history that is the most garbage period of monetary assurances for the entirety of human existence for which we have a history of. Literally, our virtual, our kind of paper representations of money becoming the dominant means really started in the 1600s, the somewhere between the 1500 and 1700 when it was really kind of set as the dominant thing. It started with the Amsterdam Bourse and the first official stock exchange, the East India Company, all of this stuff, this history where paper representations of value began to be a major flow of actual value liquidity outside of real hand-to-hand physical monetary exchange. So at best, you could argue it's like 400 years old, but all of these were what she mentioned specifically is that the currency was redeemable for something of value, for something, for some commodity. And that's specifically because the paper itself obviously has none of these attributes. It's virtual, not digital. It is virtual money. It's taking the place of some sort of a monetary good or commodity so that it can have better network and trade attributes. Because that's what the good that becomes money is ultimately used for. That's what happens, is you have a good that is on the market for some other reason, doesn't matter. You can just see this. You look at the regression theorem throughout history. It's been a billion different reasons, like leather, cattle, salt, wheat, tea bricks, all the various monetary metals. None of them have the same start. All they ever had was the fact that they are valuable for some reason, and they alone became highly liquid in the market. And specifically, they had a handful of characteristics that made them operate well as a network, as a physical network of exchange. This is why I refer to money as a network good. Go down the entire list of monetary attributes. All they are attributes that make a secure ledger. And notice not one of them has anything to do with being used for something else. In fact, quite the opposite. When something becomes money, it usually stops being used for the other things because it's far more valuable as a network good. This is why monetary goods have something referred to as a monetary premium, a value well above and beyond whatever the hell you can actually use them for. That value is sustained by the fact that you can't create more of it, and a network was established for you to trade it against other things. So going back to this semantic definition of money, which we've talked about, of this unit of account, store value, unit of account, medium of exchange, which seems to be kind of the shallow perspective here, and on top of the random element of government has to enforce it, that is one of those, oh, you're from finance and you don't know anything about money sort of statements. But the semantic theory of money tells us nothing about what happens when monies compete, why one money is better than another. It's extremely circular. Like, to say that, you know, the money is the most accepted good means that a money that is dying for 100 years and failing because another money is better while it is growing is still the money right up until the point that the other one takes over. But you can learn absolutely nothing from that definition that would say why one would be better than another. So it becomes self-referential. It's like saying that the dollar is the money because everybody accepts the dollar, but everybody accepts and uses the dollar because it's the money. Okay, thanks, but why is that? And, you know, I have to give some leeway here. You know, it makes sense that people in finance would think that they have some understanding, that because they are so close and they work with money all the time, that they have some understanding of it. But it's very much like asking a fish to describe and, you know, talk about the makeup of water and why it is and what being wet is like. And it's also a problem of timeline as well, because people in finance think 10 years back, 20 years back, oh, I'm doing deep, deep history and I have a very in-depth knowledge of the dollar and its history, when literally monetary shifts happen on the order of centuries. Like, it's like 100 to 200 years, like every time. Even the demonetization of the glass beads and, you know, seashells took the better part of 2 centuries. I guess glass beads on the African coast, that was more of a 100-year shift, really. But you get the idea. It's a whole hell of a lot longer than, you know, the last debt cycle, and you're never going to get any in-depth knowledge of it by studying the, you know, short history of the New York Stock Exchange. But a really great example is actually the Rhinestones of the Yap Islands, of the Yapese. This is a money built entirely of giant rock discs that didn't move, that lasted, worked for 5 centuries, half a millennia. And it just emerged from their culture and their society. And it served that purpose because it had those necessary attributes of a monetary good, and it worked as a ledger. One of the best things about them was that they didn't move, so you can easily see where they were. I mean, sometimes the smaller ones, people would actually move them to where they were, and that's actually why they were part of the reason why they were around, is you could actually move them when you were making a large trade. But for most of the time, they largely just kind of sat where they were, especially the large ones, the ones that were real value. 5 centuries. 5 centuries this lasted. You know what the average lifespan of a fiat currency, the thing that she claims is necessary for a thing to be money, government enforcement, the average lifespan is about 20 years of literally all monetary goods. Seashells kick fiat money's ass when it comes to longevity and security. So I hope I have hit this point enough. Gold did not become the longest running, highest assurance, most accepted king of all monetary history because a government enforced people to use it. To the contrary, every government that tried to deny it, that tried to debase it, that tried to cover up and control it, failed. Money is an emergent thing. It is emergent in literally any economy that scales beyond just, you know, a couple of dozen people. And, you know, Bitcoiners actually, this is something that I will criticize Bitcoiners on, is the fact that we too often use the barter argument or the explanation of barter as why money arises. But if you listen to, like, David Graeber's, or read David Graeber's Debt, the First 5,000 Years, there's a really great perspective here in understanding why money happens at scale and why it doesn't at very small scale, or it's less likely to at very small scale and with extremely coherent, or coherence, not the word, extremely tight and culturally aligned communities, tribes, you know, small, very small civilizations. The reason I think the barter example, even though it's conceptually really good of the, like, oh, I don't want to, you know, I don't have chickens right now, and all I have are, you know, shoes, and this other person wants chickens, but I really need his beer. You have this enormous coordination problem in the double coincidence of wants and the double coincidence of wants across both time, item itself, and then space, that you have to be in the same location as the person who wants the thing. So there's multiple layers in which this is a horribly inefficient system. But this is why barter largely never even really existed. There's no substantial society or time period in which barter was the main element for trade. In fact, it's usually this kind of like end of the order sort of, we have no other options, two communities who are separate and don't have much in common, and they come together in some sort of an event, like, you know, the settlers and the Native Americans sort of thing. Like, you have these two disparate civilizations and societies that barter based on their high value good. But any sort of recurring trade, if you do that 2 times, 3 times with some other community, you end up with the money. You just do, because barter generally sucks. If you think, if you barter with guns the first time and then come back, you know, a year later and bring a whole bunch of extra guns, you might find out that all of their guns work. In fact, they figured out how to make them, and so now they're fine. And this time they need actually, you know, slicing knives or something. Now you've stocked up on guns. That's not what they need. So if barter was never a major form of trade, what happens in small communities? Credit. You just maintain a ledger with trust, because when you're in a small community with lots of trust, you can just trust people. I would go out, hunt a deer, and then I would let you have some for the meal, and we would just kind of tally in our head that, I've given you a positive, you need to give me something back at some point. Sometimes it was official. You would literally write down a debt, you know, like tally sticks and like these sorts of things. You would have some sort of an official process of saying this person has 20 sheep worth of debt or 5 barrels of corn or whatever it would be. But a lot of times it was informal, especially when you're talking about smaller communities, tribes, that sort of thing. Where money is most needed and why it always emerges is because when you scale up across communities, across tribes, across civilizations, you need some sort of medium that can be trusted in spite of the fact that you cannot trust the person you're trading with, because you don't have any cultural ties. You don't even know if their values are the same. So how do you maintain property rights? How do you maintain value exchange without having to deal with the horrible, inefficient mess of barter across communities that you cannot establish trust with, that you cannot establish credit with? Money practically immediately emerges in a very, very short time because it is necessary for the network to grow, and the network of trade is the most valuable thing. When we talk about a network of trade, what we mean is the existence of a society versus not having one. That is what the network creates, society. This episode is brought to you by Swan Bitcoin. I want to share something from one of the episodes we did recently, because Swan has a Bitcoin treasury for, like, Bitcoin for your business management plan. How do you get your business, your trust, your nonprofit plugged into Bitcoin with a Bitcoin strategy and even on a Bitcoin standard? So this is from Reed 788, the quote: "It would be impossible to overstate the corporate advantages of being on the Bitcoin standard. Since 2017, we've doubled our franchises to 10, more than 10x'd our trading profits, and delivered 25% annualized ROE for our shareholders. Our firm compensation, rent, and total expenses are up 89%, 119%, and 69% respectively in fiat, and down 36%, 26%, and 43% respectively denominated in Bitcoin." I recommend Reed 788 if you haven't listened to it, but this is a company that has been on the Bitcoin standard, and they are looking at the rising prices of all of their costs, except that they save in Bitcoin. Their treasury reserve asset is Bitcoin, and denominated in Bitcoin, all of their costs are falling. Swan Bitcoin can help you get your treasury allocated to Bitcoin, to set up your Bitcoin treasury, to set up a Bitcoin benefit plan for your employees, to stay informed, get industry reports, and all of the assistance and knowledge that you need around getting yourself on a Bitcoin standard. And this is just the beginning of what Swan offers. They have an entire financial suite of services. And as always, if you just want a place to go buy Bitcoin with low fees and automatically withdraw to your cold storage, Swan's got you. Check out swanbitcoin.com/guy. The link is in the show notes. All right, so let's kind of go through this Twitter post just kind of one by one here. So first she hits, there's no premium in scarcity, so it's not valuable just because it's limited. And the fact that some Bitcoiners rely on that as kind of the fundamental thing for why it's valuable, she's right. The premium in scarcity comes to something that is valuable. If it is valuable and it is scarce, it will maintain a premium. Why? Because as more people value it, as more people find it and find that it is useful for something, you can't make more of it. Thus, premium. This is one of the most basic supply and demand. So yes, the scarcity alone does not make it valuable. But if it is valuable and it is scarce, the more scarce it is likely means the more premium the value will have. And for a monetary good, scarcity is one of the most important. For the same reason that trying to budget using a ledger or using a bookkeeping system that just kind of inserts random numbers and changes things after it's been a week or two isn't a very good accounting system. Scarcity is critical for money because if it isn't scarce, A, you will just inflate it until the value premium is gone, and B, it cannot reflect the value of society. It doesn't actually work to account for both the rising and falling relative value of all goods in society. Everything is relative. The beauty of having a scarce money, a perfectly scarce money, is that you always know the comparative value of one thing to another because you have something that doesn't move, that is widespread across the entire network, that the network is formed around as your unit of measure, to weigh bananas against cars, to weigh iPhone 5s against iPhone 10s. So here she's technically correct. Then she says, gets that the value is not assigned just because it's scarce, but they assign even less value given all the concentration risk of ownership, corrupt actors, Russia, China, charlatans, crime, and confiscations. Man, you know, if you just keep saying something, that doesn't make it true. Crime is a huge problem in the dollar. It is not a meaningful percentage at all in Bitcoin. And that's completely beside the fact that anything that will be a successful money it necessarily will be used by criminals. And she specifically calls it concentration risk, which has me thinking, which really reveals the finance perspective, that mentality, that because she comes from a place where if you own more of it, you control it, she thinks that this has anything to do with Bitcoin, and it does not. So there is no concentration risk in the ownership. And if the presence of criminals using the network bothers you, or it ascribes less value for you or everybody, all your TradFi buddies, then I'd like to point out that Jeffrey Epstein and his multi-decade pedophilia, child rape, and trafficking scheme used JP Morgan and the dollar, not Bitcoin. I have a problem with the concentration risk, the corrupt actors, the charlatans, the crime, and the enormous debt Ponzi scheme, the largest in the history of the world, that is, the dollar and the U.S. financial system. Sorry, not sorry, look in the mirror. Talk about the pot calling the kettle black. But let's move on. So, quote, "But here's where TradFi folks really align. Bitcoin is not money." Okay. Well, it is a valuable, perfectly scarce monetary good that beats fiat money in literally every category of monetary attribute. Scarcity, divisibility, verifiability, portability, fungibility. And it is even more liquid and accepted than most of fiat currencies. It's just not geographically dense, so it doesn't look like it. There's only a few very small spots in the world, El Salvador, numerous towns or locations in Africa, Nigeria specifically, some across the Europe and the Mediterranean, even some in the U.S. that have pretty decent density of kind of acceptance and use, but it's far more sparse. It's far more spread out. But nonetheless, there are an extremely few number of currencies, a number of monetary goods in this world, which you could take, you could have, you know, $500 worth and take it to any country in the world, and you could actually expect to find a buyer to get $500 worth of the next currency, the local currency. There are very few currencies or monies that enable that, and Bitcoin is one of the very few that does. And it does very well. There's almost every country in the world you can expect to find someone to sell your Bitcoin to if you need their local currency. But here's the kicker. The attribute of acceptability and the breadth of the network are a consequence of all of the other attributes being realized in the market. It's like saying that the internet in 1995 isn't a communication system because the phone is more heavily used. Therefore, it's the communication system. This is the problem with the semantic theory of money, is you're labeling something based on the end product, the end consequences of the attributes that actually make it the thing. So in 1993, 1995, when the internet is still a smaller network than the phone network, if you say, oh, well, it's not the communication system because it's not as accepted as the phone network, well, then you're going to be really surprised when it turns out that all of the fact that all of the attributes of the internet are vastly better, more capable, and more secure than the phone network and are going to replace it. Using the metric of acceptance means that you're just going to be blindsided. Bitcoin is a monetary good. Bitcoin is used as money across the planet. And it is even legal tender in El Salvador, so it even passes the ridiculously incorrect criteria of being forced by a government. And guess what? Because it is perfectly scarce, it is growing, it continues to grow, and it has gone through multiple enormous adoption and expansion cycles in a series for the entirety of its life. It has never left a growth cycle and found a bottom below the previous bottom. You're going to be really confused when it turns out that Bitcoin is actually the best monetary ledger that we've ever had, and its price and network will reflect that. All right, back to the thread. Quote, "Beyond the core monetary commodity circulation attributes of money, actual money has to be measured in relation to a demanded in-kind commodity or currency or asset." This one I don't even, this has never been an attribute of money. This is an attribute of currency that is representative of money. Like when it's when you have a demanded commodity, the commodity is the money. So when we're talking about gold, gold was the money. Things were priced in gold. The dollar only ever even came into existence and was only ever the dominant world currency, specifically because it was backed by gold. Gold was the money. It is only in the short period since that abstraction has been defaulted on that we've been purely in an era of fiat. And it's specifically because a physical network will never work in a digital world. It loses its network properties and network security. And it even functionally loses its scarcity because you never actually interact with the physical thing in a digital world. So the settlement of the physical gold would never even be part of the trade because the trade exists entirely in the digital sphere, in the network sphere. The only time that you would actually settle in physical gold is when you were literally trying to leave the network. You were trying to exit from the network and stop trading with some portion of your of the value. So this is just another huge misunderstanding or failure of knowledge in what is actually a money. Money is not redeemable. Currency is redeemable in kind to a money, to a monetary good, because the entirety of the purpose of currency is to expand the network of that good, where the good itself cannot actually make the trade. Again, because money, historically, is specifically a good that enables a strong trade network. Then she says, and then it has to be forced on us by government. Again, she repeats that like three times in this. And I could maybe give the benefit of the doubt that maybe she's just talking about like, you know, recently, or like that's what's common in the last 50 years or whatever it is. But no, she repeats it too many times and continuously uses all caps in a bunch of these things about that particular attribute, is that she literally thinks that money is not something that emerges in society, that for it to be money, I cannot believe how common this painfully, painfully wrong idea, like that just, I mean, so completely and utterly wrong. If you just look at money, you just look at the history of money. Look at the history of government money and where all of them started. All government force does is artificially inflate the network. It's like subsidies and price controls. It's an attempt to secure monetary attributes for a virtual stand-in by beating people up for not accepting it. That is all it is. It's the shittiest, most shallow idea of monetary security you could possibly comprehend. And that's why it has the dog shittiest of track records, because you can try your damnedest to beat a market into submission and try to beat a different economic reality into your population, but none of it will ever hold up. The government isn't magic. All they can do is paper over reality until reality rises from the surface and punches them square in the face. They will fail if they try to deny real economic reality every single time. And the history of money is not even slightly ambiguous about this fact. God, anyway, let's move on. She says, so why would TradFi folks in mass trade in-kind real assets for Bitcoin other than with disposable money because of Bitcoin's speculative properties? The way she has a question, exclamation, question mark there at the end, I think that was actually like kind of a sarcastic like question, like, so they would trade it for this sort of thing. And I don't think I read it that way in the clip at the beginning. So that's me being a bad narrator. I did not understand that was the tonality she was going for, but I see it now. I have failed you and I'm sorry. The spirit of the thread did not come through in my narration. But I digress. Back to the point. So why would they trade in-kind assets for Bitcoin other than just using disposable money? I would ask, why the hell would they trade scarce assets for dollars that are going to be guaranteed to lose money or lose value? The only reason the dollar remains dominant is because of the size of its network, not because of its monetary properties. Its monetary value is defended by its network, but its monetary properties are dog shit. So the reason one would trade their assets for a nascent money that has better monetary properties and a growing network is because on a long time frame, they will not be debased. And if that network continues to grow at all, either internally in the fact that it gets more productive, or externally in the fact that more people leave from the crappy fiat network and move to the Bitcoin network, that they will have the same portion of that network's purchasing power. Simply put, they would trade low monetary guarantees for high monetary guarantees, taking the risk on the size of the network solely. Which is not a difficult risk if you look at the history and growth of the Bitcoin network, that what it is doing is growing. And once you understand that its value as a monetary good and ledger is both serving its purpose and growing at an accelerating rate, now the question is, how scarce is the good you are holding? How much more of what you have can someone else make to dilute it? Because one way or the other, you are using a money that someone else can cheat. The question is, do you want to use a fair money instead of an unfair one? Do you want to use a money where everyone has the exact same rules, and therefore everyone is contributing the same and voluntarily trading in order to obtain it? Or one where someone can literally consume as much resources from the network as possible and not actually provide anything in return because they can counterfeit the units? Do you want a counterfeitable currency that you can't counterfeit, or a counterfeit-proof currency where you and everyone else have the same set of rules? Because you're using unbacked digital points no matter what option you go with. So the question is, do you want monetary assurances with those points, or do you want a monetary master? You should never work for money that someone else can make an unlimited amount of for free. And then we're back to, the state does not enforce Bitcoin as a real currency, so it's not money. Okay, we're done with that. So we can trade it, transact where we can, blah, blah, blah. But there's too much risk for the reward for those who have money. Somebody has not done their financial risk assessment. There's nothing. Look at the history. Seriously, Samantha, if you actually have made it this far and you're listening to this, do a risk assessment. Do a 5% allocation portfolio over any 4 years of Bitcoin's existence. Do an assessment of the network growth. Actually look into what's happening. Look at the Lightning Network. Look at the Bitcoin adoption. Then compare that to the dollar risk. Compare that to the amount of money that has been printed. Compare that to the debt that is actually backstopping the prices of everything. Debt that are literally... We have entire retirement accounts. Our entire stock market is backed by promises that nobody can pay. Like 80% of the value is just a stack of promises. It's not really there. Look at the fiat timeline. Look at the history of money and the changing world orders and global currency shifts and see what you actually get. Because I promise you, Michael Saylor and MicroStrategy, Stone Ridge, Fidelity, they did run the numbers, and it has worked out swimmingly for all of them. All right, back to the thread. For those who need it, I agree, it's a powerful, effective payment system. It's a consensus system. It's not a payment system. Payment systems will be built on top of it. Payment systems will be built with it. Blockchain is not a scalable payment system. It is a consensus system. It's about establishing a trusted set of rules that no individual party, no degree of ownership within that set of rules or within the units can actually alter the rules themselves. It is, how do you agree upon a set of rules and a monetary element? How do you agree upon and enforce a monetary unit in a vast global community without a central enforcer, without a punisher of last resort, who is ultimately also a cheater of last resort, or cheater of first resort, honestly. This is where so many people get it wrong. Bitcoin's innovation is not in payments. Bitcoin's innovation is proof of work consensus on a set of rules that can be trusted when you cannot trust who you are trading with, when credit doesn't work. It is a digital monetary good. All right, back to it. Does that sound elitist or just realist? Whatever. Speaking from TradFi perspective, Bitcoin is a little alt investment, diversify returns, blah, blah, blah. Sure. I mean, I get that perspective that they think that. But the main reason most TradFi types have no interest is because they don't need or trust get-rich schemes. I don't even need to address this one. Bitcoin is not a get-rich scheme. Bitcoin is murder. Bitcoin is volatile as hell. There aren't guarantees of shit in Bitcoin. Bitcoin is not a get-rich-quick scheme. It is a better money scheme. And if you ask any real Bitcoiner, they will tell you you'd be stupid for trading a bunch of crypto garbage, for trading Bitcoin at all, because long-term, it is a long-term asset to buy and hold, to build a position in as its network grows, and then use it as money where it is available as the network expands. It's more like building out internet infrastructure and investing in the ownership of the network potential of the internet before the internet is actually big, before literally websites are normal. This is an open, permissionless protocol for money. All of finance will be disrupted in the exact same way that the open, permissionless network and protocol for the internet, for communications, disrupted all of our communication systems and apparatuses. If you are not prepared for that, if you are not hedging into that, you are likely going to have a very rude awakening in a not too distant future. All right, again, back to it. And again, I just want to say, again, if Samantha's still here, or just in general, I get really passionate and intense about this sort of stuff, but I literally don't mean any disrespect. Like, I understand that our perspectives are entirely built upon our knowledge and our exposure to ideas, like 100%. I really try not to hold it against people that they think differently. Like, I mean, that's not only is that just generally unwise, but it's also like a horrible strategy for life. You're just going to be miserable and you're going to hate everybody and everybody's going to be stupid because nobody's ever going to think exactly like you do about everything. So anyway, just a little caveat there. Going back, so, and they know those with real power and money know how to take yours away. If you're trading. Sadly, if I was a betting woman, I would say this is their tool to use against you, hashtag Bitcoin ETFs. I'm not sure if she's referring to Bitcoin specifically or the ETFs. She's talking about the ETFs? Yeah, probably. I mean, they're going to wipe the floor with anybody who thinks that they can now trade Bitcoin because they're going to be moving the flows constantly, but they are not going to be able to stop the network growth, which is going to raise the underlying, the floor for the price. Basically, that hard undergirding growth that has continued to lift the lows over and over and over again. Now, if she's talking about Bitcoin, that now this is their tool to use against us, sorry, but you don't understand how Bitcoin works, if that's the argument. But if we're talking about the Bitcoin ETFs, yeah, there's not really, I mean, we've talked about this pretty heavily. Maybe you can don't remember the number. Trust Me Bro was the piece by Alan Farrington where we kind of got into that the first time. But yeah, the ETFs are nothing special. They're just another paper Bitcoin instrument. The single thing that the ETFs do that is a benefit is the fact that it exposes it. It exposes a social legitimacy and opens an avenue of network expansion that will ultimately lead right back to the fundamental Bitcoin network expansion. But it is just paper instruments. It's going to benefit them a whole lot more than it will benefit us in the short to medium term. And if you're trading, you're just going to get your ass handed to you. Back to it. I'm sorry, it's not fair. They suck. I'm not being facetious. Fair. Maybe you will change the game by changing the players or the pieces, but until then, Bitcoin does not meet the definition of money. We already talked about this. I don't agree at all with your definition of money. It's largely reliant on the semantic theory of money, which, as I said, is really entirely uninformative and doesn't give us really any useful information. Quote, regardless of the Bitcoin gospel writers have changed the definition of money. No, we didn't. Or intrinsic value or ascribe Bitcoin with the characteristics of money, blah, 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 value, trust, whatever. Bitcoin is rogue money. Okay. See, this is silly. We're just randomly defining, making up immediately after saying, if you just change the definition of money or intrinsic value, now we just make up a term called rogue money. Rogue money is otherwise known as money in which you put the word rogue at the front of it, which she then says is on the opposite spectrum to sound money. Rogue money isn't a thing. You just invented rogue money. And it is not on the opposite spectrum to sound money because rogue money doesn't exist. Money has assurances. It has clear characteristics of what the underlying good can protect in the context of a monetary network. Bitcoin is good money, fiat is trash money, gold is good physical money, shitty digital money, and the dollar simply has the biggest network of the three. But sound money is explicitly referring to the monetary assurances. Bitcoin's monetary assurances are an order of magnitude. They're not even comparable to the dollar's monetary assurances, because the dollar's monetary assurances are being cheated right now. Right at this very moment, they're proving that there are no assurances. You are just hoping that the people who can print as much money as they possibly want in the financial system that is insolvent and lending money out of thin air, that they will be restrained to not do it too much. And so the cost of housing will only double in like 7 years as opposed to three. So I don't know what the hell rogue money is. But between fiat and Bitcoin, Bitcoin has vastly more secure monetary assurances. And you can verify it on your own computer down to the 1/100 millionth of a unit, all the way back to the very beginning of Bitcoin's existence. On the other hand, in fiat, there has never been one independent or reliable audit of the Federal Reserve. Never. And you still wouldn't be able to verify it yourself. You would just have to trust whatever the hell they reported. So anyway, quote, rogue money has a purpose, but not transformational power, unless you change the state and get it to literally force it upon us. No, Bitcoin will, good money will emerge in spite of the state. What we have lacked is a technological solution to the fact that we live in a digital space, a paper money world, where all exchange ended up being with a third party. And a third party is easy to control. It's easy to create permissioned walls around. It is easy to whitelist who is able to access the system. That is the problem. The reason we have nothing but fiat money is not because governments force fiat money and then that just makes money different. It's because we had no technological solution to creating independent money in the digital, in the virtual space, and you cannot send gold over the internet. So no, we do not need the state to enforce Bitcoin or anything, because the state will have to adopt Bitcoin. If the monetary assurances continue to be monetary assurances, it is not broken, its network continues to grow, and it continues to become more and more valuable, governments will not have a choice. Money is an all or nothing competition. It is a competition of network strength. Any growth in one explicitly means a decline in its alternative. And part of the thing that ensures the monetary assurances are its network growth, its network size. Governments and countries will adopt Bitcoin and use Bitcoin for the exact same reason that gunpowder was adopted. It wasn't because everybody was a religious zealot or they super believed in gunpowder. It was because if they didn't, they would have been walked over by the society next to them that did adopt gunpowder. Bitcoin is the economic equivalent of this. Monetary competition in general is the economic equivalent of this. If there is a monetary shift happening, you sure as hell do not want to be on the declining side. All right, back to it. In the meantime, Bitcoiners, feel free to treat crypto assets as a cause within a religion. No, Bitcoiners don't care about crypto assets. Bitcoiners care about Bitcoin because money is a winner-take-all system. And money is about trust. Nobody trusts crypto, and nobody needs a bunch of random payment features and wing digits and gadgets on their money. That is why you have money. It is an independent, trusted system so that you can then buy wing digits and gadgets and create whatever network you want on top of it or with it. But it's also not a religion. In fact, it's ironic because fiat is far closer to a religion than Bitcoin. Bitcoin is actually consensus upon a real set of rules in which everybody actually participates with the same amount of restriction. A religion is something where you worship someone, and it is almost always based on a system of authority. The idea that somebody's unbacked bullshit promises are worth something, and that they can print them out of thin air, and that this somehow magically solves problems and creates more resources into existence that wouldn't have happened otherwise, that's a religion. That is actually a really stupid religion, because none of it has anything to do with reality. You can't just write down on a piece of paper, this is more wealth, and then suddenly you have more TVs. I can't counterfeit. I can't cheat my budget at the end of the month and just punch in a bunch of extra numbers and be like, oh, I actually made money instead of lost money. That sounds like a pretty silly religion to me. But nobody thinks it is, because it's normal for everyone to believe something so absurd. So back to it, don't disrespect those who don't share your beliefs. Okay. I mean, you know, don't take it as disrespect if I disagree. I mean, honestly, this is a pretty respectful post, largely, so I appreciate that. And I largely try to be respectful. I don't win all the time. It's a battle. But I also am not going to call something not stupid when I think it's stupid. So anyway, quote, we can survive and thrive together. It's not all or nothing. Money, the game of money kind of is, but okay. But do study the strengths and weaknesses of your new weapon of change. Well, that's what we do at Bitcoin Audible. We study the strengths and the weaknesses. And then back to it. For example, I can call US dollar monopoly money. Sure, that's because it is. Because it can be printed, devalued, debased, de-dollarized, but it is still the tool that enables all other tools. No, it's not a tool that enables other tools. It's the network by which all other tools are connected to. Money is the tool that enables all economic cooperation, which means it is the tool that enables society to flourish. The dollar is a network that has been monopolized and can be cheated by a very small group of people such that they can degrade society to their explicit profit and power. But the dollar is simply the largest monetary network, not the best monetary good. It's simply that the size of the network is critical in the short-term value proposition, in the short-term purchasing power and access to that monetary good, or to the monetary economy, to the society. All right, quote, I hope Bitcoin sticks around and grows more popular, but in its current form, most TradFi, it is the opposite of sound money, especially if it takes cult-like behavior to make it grow. Well, good news. It does not require cult-like behavior to grow. Never did. In fact, the handful of people on Twitter who are kind of Bitcoin crazies are just that, a handful of people on Bitcoin Twitter. We really need to stop, get out of this mindset that social media is actually reality, that you can like take a map of like what the people are saying or doing on Twitter, and thus this is what everybody in this little corner or every little thing, like this is the world. It is not. It is what the Twitter algorithm thinks will keep you looking at the feed. And then the people up there are the product of what that algorithm does to the brain. All right, that quote, it says, it needs the state to force its use on everyone. We're like the fourth time that it's not money without the state. This is what makes it money. And what are the Vegas odds for that? I don't know, really. El Salvador did it. I mean, it's got to be better than the lottery. Quote, especially since you disdain the state and the state disdains your rogueness. Well, the state can lick my balls. I do not want or need their approval, and I do not want or need them to force it on anybody. That's actually against the principles that created Bitcoin in the first place. It's voluntary. It doesn't need anybody to force it on them because it's going to work because it's better. That's why. It will be chosen voluntarily. It will win in spite of the fiat trash that is backed by the violence of forcing it on everyone. And I happily stake my reputation on that. All right, quote, final word, many in TradFi don't dismiss you, but that doesn't mean we will ever convert to your gospel of Bitcoin. Okay, nobody cares. Or worship terms most of you don't understand, like debasement. Seriously, how many of you ever knew this term existed before jumping on the Bitcoin train? This is a terrible argument. Now, I could say, like personally, it's like I did Austrian economics for years. Like those things led me to Bitcoin, not the other way around. But regardless, the idea that it's somehow a negative or it's somehow indicative of something bad that people learned about what money was after they came to Bitcoin and they learned how they were getting scammed, because it turns out of the three people in the neighborhood, two people were doing work and one person was counterfeiting the money and buying up all the shit. And then that person's looking at the other two is like, you didn't even care about debasement until you found out about it. Okay. That's a bad argument. Warning, this one term has become the calling card for enabling this cult-like separateness. Your rogueness is cool, but wishing promoting bad things on your state is a really bad investment framework. Oh yeah, for sure. Ask Julian Assange about exposing corruption, crimes, and murder. About promoting and wishing bad things on corrupt and terrible people. But we're not going to stop because it's not an investment strategy. It's a principle, you coward. If you aren't calling out bad people for doing horrible things, for cheating, for stealing, for blatant and disgusting levels of corruption, you're the shitty person. especially if you're doing it to protect your investment. Sorry, not sorry on that one. This one reveals a gross set of principles on your side, not ours. And then, quote, to do so, you just separate yourself even farther away from the people and policies that will continue to label you and your money as rogue. Okay, I don't really have a problem with that. I don't really want to be associated with those people anyway. They're not good people, and they believe this weird culty religion that the government can just do whatever they want and cheat endlessly and commit murder, and that somehow these things are their right, that this is just normal and acceptable. I refuse to participate in that crazy cult anymore. And I think the rules should be fair, and they should apply to everyone, and that there should not be monetary masters. There should be monetary rules that we all follow. And I am sick of having my savings debased. I am sick of the prices of everything skyrocketing endlessly. I am sick of the monetary network of the world being used to control and enslave people. So if our constant talking about those things are going to separate us from them, that's kind of the point. We don't want to join them. We want to undermine their entire system. That's what we're trying to do. And I gotta say, we're doing a pretty good job. It's messy. It's not perfect. But I gotta say, it's a whole hell of a lot better than selling my soul and joining the bastards just for an investment framework. I think we should solve problems rather than investing in them. And fiat money is a problem. It is a big, terrible problem, and we aim to fix it. You do not have to invest in it at all. But thank you for your input. All right, that'll close us out. We got through the whole thing. I will say again, I know I got a little obnoxious there at the end. And I do apologize for the aggressiveness of the way that I argued if Samantha's not listening to this anymore. But just in case, I do apologize. I do respect that you feel and think differently. It really does not bother me. I just really get heated and I kind of love this sort of debate. And somehow that's just how it comes out when I talk. But I don't apologize for my opinions or anything that I said. Maybe just how I said it. But that'll close us out. All right, guys. Thank you so much for listening to this Guy's Take episode. A thank you to Samantha LeDuc for her entertaining Twitter post. And a thank you to our amazing sponsors, CoinKite and Swan Bitcoin. You buy your Bitcoin on Swan and you send it straight to your cold card hardware wallet from CoinKite. Don't forget, all the amazing details, links, and goodies will be in the show notes, so check them out. We have got an amazing lineup for next week, so don't miss it. I just got off a conversation with Devin Erickson, and you are not going to want to miss this one. It was so fun. So I will catch you on the next one. I am Guy Swan, and until then, everybody, take it easy, guys. Facts do not cease to exist because they are ignored. Aldous Huxley.